Hello, 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 and welcome again to the Bible Gumshoe, the podcast dedicated to investigating tough questions about the Bible and its origins. I'm Nicholas LeMay, your host and resident Bible detective, and again, I'm thrilled to have you with us today. It's always my goal that on these podcasts, we can enrich your thinking and reading of the Bible, and that, well, we can all learn at least one new thing, maybe two if we're lucky. So, as I mentioned on the last show, this month is September, and it's the month of the Bible. So I want to dedicate this month's shows to questions about the Bible's nature and its origins. Today we're not going to be asking a question as such, but rather telling a story. And I think it's a rather remarkable story. Maybe you didn't realize it, but during the times of Jesus and the apostles, people didn't tend to speak Hebrew, the Hebrew of their ancestors. And while it's true that they could read it, well, at least some could read it, they spoke predominantly Aramaic and Greek. An example of this can actually be found in Mark 5:41, where Jesus raises a centurion's daughter who had died, and he says to her, "Talitha kumi." Mark's aware that his Greek readers don't understand Aramaic, and so he translates it for us. He says, which means, "Little girl, I say to you, rise." Another notable example of this is when Jesus is on the cross and he's close to death and he cries out in anguish with those immortal words, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani." And Mark, aware that the Greek reader isn't going to understand this, translates it as, my God, why have you forsaken me?" This was a multilingual period. But the Jews no longer spoke Hebrew. They spoke Aramaic. And they also spoke Greek. The fact that they spoke Greek was due to an interesting historical cultural process we call Hellenism. Or perhaps we could say a Greekifying of all the lands conquered by Alexander the Great. This is really where our story begins, with the great conqueror Alexander and his plan for Greek acculturation of all of his conquered subjects. How did this work out? And what does it have to do with the Bible? Well, after the death and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth, his apostles and the early Christians began to preach the good news of the gospel in Jerusalem and in every part of the Roman Empire. Paul began writing his epistles, and then the evangelists began composing their gospel narratives about Jesus' life and ministry. And they weren't doing this in their native Aramaic. Well, I mean, in fact, at least two gospel writers, Mark and Luke, weren't even Jewish, but Gentile converts who spoke Greek as their first language. So they wrote in Greek. In fact, all of them wrote in Greek, and they wrote in Greek for a Greek-speaking audience in the Roman Empire. Now, Greek wasn't some heavenly language. It wasn't like the manna that descended in the wilderness. It was a common language. It was a common language of all people all over the empire. It was a language of trade, commerce, and day-to-day interaction in the marketplace. It was the language of the philosophers and the learned. It was the perfect language to communicate God's good news about Jesus in the Greco-Roman world. This happened in large measure because as the New Testament was being written, it wasn't meant for the elite only. It wasn't meant for the people who lived in their ivory towers or as a secret wisdom only for the properly initiated. The message of the cross was for all people, regardless of nationality or social status. In order for the Bible as we know it, with Old and New Testaments, to become a reality, two great events had to coincide just at the right time and under the right circumstances. The first we've already alluded to, but it bears repeating, and we should go into a little more detail. Alexander the Great, right? The son of King Philip of Macedonia, had great ambition. He wanted to conquer all of the known world and expand his empire, and he met with incredible success. Part of his plan of expansion was not simply political conquest, but cultural and linguistic hegemony as well. What Alexander could never have imagined was that his plan of conquest and cultural and linguistic domination were all part of God's plan to prepare the way for Christianity. It's arguable that had Alexander not had so much military success, or if he had been unsuccessful in acculturating the conquered masses, Christianity as we know it would never have existed, and neither would our Bible have existed. In 331 BC, Alexander conquered the Persian Empire and had extended his influence all the way to India. But 12 short years later, his power was cut off and he died. While his conquest was very brief, it left a mark on history that arguably is still being felt today. Wherever he conquered, he implemented an ideology of cultural, linguistic, and religious hegemony, which today we call Hellenism. The nations, while they were allowed to retain their gods, their customs, and their practices, had to acculturate to a new set of cultural and religious ideals. It was a vast transformation of the world after the image of Alexander's Greece. This ideology was embraced by many, even many of the Jews, who for expediency's sake saw this as a positive movement. For other Jews, well, the case was a little bit different. Hellenism plunged them into a four-century conflict with their desire to worship Yahweh in purity and the increasingly powerful demand of the surrounding culture to accommodate, to adjust. Now, at the same time, the Greek language became what we call the lingua franca of the whole world. That means that it was the language spoken by everybody, everywhere, in commerce and in all normal activity, much like English is today. And together with cultural Hellenism, this actually allowed for a more rapid expansion of the Roman Empire. It also made possible the rapid and unstoppable expansion of Christianity much later, and the rapid growth of the church. So in order to truly establish this hegemony over his conquered lands, Alexander decided to build a great city in his honor. This city of Alexandria was built in Egypt between the Mediterranean Sea and an impenetrable swamp. It ultimately came to have a population of some 300,000 inhabitants. It established itself as the epicenter for culture, thought, and literature in the Greek-speaking world. They had a library that was unrivaled in the whole of the empire. And interestingly, the Jews that settled there and actually assimilated with very few problems. In 301 BC, when Ptolemy conquered Jerusalem and Palestine, the Jews that came over not only assimilated quickly, but they actually came to occupy high positions in the government and administration of the city. This is the historical background, okay? The historical background of what is arguably the most important translation in all of antiquity, without which Christianity may have been impossible. I know that's an incredible claim, isn't it? But bear with me. We're almost done with the story. What follows is almost certainly a mixture of true history and a little bit of creative legend. So, here goes. There's an ancient document known as the Letter of Aristeus. This is where we get our information about this incredible translation. In this letter, we learn that the translation of the Hebrew scriptures into Greek was suggested to King Ptolemy II. I mean, his reign was between 285 and 247 BC. And this translation was suggested to the king in order that it might be included in the royal library. Alexandria boasted the greatest library on earth at the time. I just want to read a small portion of this letter so we can get an idea of what was behind the translation of the Hebrew scriptures into the Greek tongue. In this letter, we're given a sort of transcript of a letter composed by a certain Demetrius to the king. And he writes this. He says, "To the great king, a statement submitted by Demetrius, in obedience to thy order, king, concerning the books that are wanting to complete the library, that these should be added to the collection, and that those which have been lost should be duly replaced. After making careful inquiry into these matters, I refer the following statement to thee. Certain two books of the Jewish law, with some few others, are wanting. 30 for these are composed in Hebrew letters and in the Hebrew tongue, but have been interpreted somewhat carelessly, and not according to their true meaning, according to information supplied by experts, because they have not hitherto received the supervision of royalty. And it is necessary that these books should be should in an amended form find a place in thy library, because these laws, in that they are divine, are most full of wisdom and faultless. For this reason, the writers of prose and verse and the host of historians have avoided any mention of the books aforesaid and of the men who have lived and are living their lives in accordance with them, because the views presented in them have a certain sanctity and holiness, as says Hectaeus of Abdera. Be it then thy good pleasure, King, that a letter be written to the high priest at Jerusalem, by parentheses, whose name was Eleazar, bidding him send such men as have lived the best of lives and are advanced in years, versed in their country's law, 6 from each tribe, in order that we may test wherein the more part agree, and so obtaining an accurate translation may deposit it in a conspicuous place in a manner worthy of the undertaking and of thy gracious will. Farewell. So, there's the letter. And as the story goes, the high priest Eleazar sent 6 bilingual scholars to Alexandria from each of the tribes of Israel, which amount 72 in all. And this is where this translation gets its particular name, the Septuagint, which means 70 in Latin. The Jews from the diaspora had assimilated so much the culture around them that most didn't even know how to speak or read Hebrew, like we've mentioned before. Many of them, as we've already said, spoke Aramaic, and almost everyone spoke Greek. The Septuagint, translated some 250 years before Jesus' birth, really became the Bible of the Jews throughout the Roman Empire. We find the Septuagint cited often in the New Testament, more often than any other version of the Hebrew Scriptures. This was the Bible of the apostles and gospel writers. A very famous quote, just to give an example, from the Septuagint that we find in the New Testament comes from Matthew 1:22-23. And all this was written to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which means God with us. Now in the Hebrew, Alma, the word here translated virgin, Alma, could have just meant a young woman, without reference to virginity as such. But the Greek word used in the Septuagint is a more technical term for virgin, Parthenos. There's so many other places. You can see how that would affect, right, the understanding of the gospel writers of the biblical prophecy from Isaiah. So there are many more places that we could look at in the New Testament where the writers use the Septuagint, and that could make it for a, really could make for a fascinating study in future podcasts. But for now, let's just reflect on what all of this means for the Bible. We really can't overemphasize the importance of this translation for the New Testament and for the birth of Christianity. It served as the foundation for the composition of the New Testament, and it served as a pattern for future translations of the Bible after the age of the apostles. Its influence was also of inestimable value for the transmission of the Christian message throughout the entire Roman Empire, and it played a very important role in Jewish-Christian polemics about the identity of Jesus of Nazareth during the first 4 centuries after Jesus' death and resurrection. Now think about this. How amazing that what started out as a project for the honor and glory of Greek culture and the library in Alexandria had a greater purpose in the plan of God. While men imagined glory for themselves and their posterity, God was actually using it to establish his kingdom and promote the message of his good news throughout the entire Roman Empire 250 years after its original translation. That is an incredible story. And had it not been for Alexander's conquest and the expansion of Hellenism, the Christian church and the Bible of the Old and New Testaments might never have become a reality. This was a story of the conquest, the great conquest, that gave us our Bible. Well, thank you guys for joining me on this episode of the Bible Gumshoe Podcast as we explore the origins of the Bible during the month of September, the month of the Bible. Of course, if you have any questions of your own you'd like answered, please write me at questions@biblegumshoe.com. That's questions at BibleGumshoe.com. And of course, you can check out our webpage at www.BibleGumshoe.com. There on our website, we have listed all of the programs planned and the dates for September. And please, subscribe to us on iTunes and on Google Play Music. And leave a comment. You know that your comments will really help boost our ratings on those platforms. And it would be great to read some of your thoughts and comments on the show. It really helps us out. Next time, we're going to look at the emperor who gave us the Bible. And until then, this is Nicholas LeMay, your resident Bible detective, signing off.
Blah, blah, blah.